In the new book, The Wannabe Fascists, Federico Finkelstein offers a precise explanation of why Trumpism and similar movements across the world belong to a new political breed, the wannabe fascists. Drawing on almost three decades of research on the histories of fascism and populism around the world, Finkelstein lays out in clear language what the author calls the four pillars of fascism: xenophobia, propaganda, political violence, and ultimately, dictatorship. Learn more about The Wannabe Fascists by Federico Finkelstein at ucpress.edu.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm Didi Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. If there's one thing everyone knows about American politics, it's that there is no way for a Democrat to win the presidency without black voters. That's one of the reasons why, as Joe Biden fights desperately to stay in the 2024 election, not to mention on the ticket for the 2024 election, he's made an aggressive effort to shore up black support. In recent days, Biden has spoken at black churches, given interviews to black radio hosts, and leaned on the powerful Congressional Black Caucus to help bolster his political defenses. But there are signs that black voters may not be ready to turn out for Biden quite as fervently as he needs them to. In the past few months, polls have shown black support for Biden slipping to levels Democrats have not seen in generations. So, can Biden overcome doubts about his fitness, reverse these trends, and hold the White House? Should we even believe the polls? And are we in the middle of a historic shift in the relationship between black voters and the Democratic Party? To discuss all this, I'm thrilled to be joined by a powerhouse trio of guests: Christina Greer, Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University; Steve Phillips, political strategist, Nation contributor, and author most recently of How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good; and Adolf Reed Jr., Nation columnist and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, all of you, to See How They Run. I guess we really ought to begin this discussion by asking, should we be talking about the black vote? Is the black vote still a thing? And maybe we should begin with the political scientists. Christina, do you want to go first on that?
Sure. I guess since Adolf's on the podcast, we'll go with youth before knowledge when it comes to the political scientists on the podcast. You know, the black vote is still very much a thing for the Democratic Party. You know, we know that black women are the keepers of democracy and the Democratic Party. We know that black men are also the keepers of the Democratic Party. Both groups vote either 95 or roughly 90% for the Democratic Party every presidential election. There is no road to the White House for a Democrat without black voters. We've seen Joe Biden recognize the significance of black voters. He, I think, leans very heavily on the mentorship and advice of James Clyburn when it comes to black voters, because if we remember back in 2020, Joe Biden would not be in the White House had it not been for James Clyburn in South Carolina. You know, that galvanized his primary campaign and sort of coalesced a lot of black leaders around him. So I think, even though I wrote a book called Black Ethnics, looking at the diversity of black ethnic groups in the United States, Caribbeans, Africans, and native-born black Americans, I think in the political space, when we think about big D Democratic voting, we can still say that black voters, by and large, vote for the Democratic Party at much more robust and significant numbers than any other racial ethnic group in the United States.
Adolf, as our other political scientist here.
Yeah, well, it's a big tent discipline, you know. Yeah, I guess I have a different kind of perspective on the black vote or the idea of the black vote. Part of it has to do with what is the black vote and how do we know what the black vote is? I mean, I recall that my son, who for the record is not a political scientist but is an historian, was kind of feverishly advising connections that he had in the Sanders campaign in 2019. That it was a mistake to go campaigning for something called the black vote, because what the black vote is basically the kind of black professional managerial stratum agenda, or is tied to a black professional managerial class agenda that is committed to a race reductionist view of politics and is not amenable, right, or or does not conduce to constructing a majoritarian coalition around the kind of the sort that Sanders at least wanted to put together. It does, however, conduce to a kind of majoritarian coalition that the Clintonite wing of the Democratic Party must put together. Right? So it avoids, so when we talk about this thing called the black vote, and especially since 2015 or 2016, we're assuming something that is not especially committed to a broadly redistributive political agenda, and is kind of race reductionist in its politics. And by the way, the idea that, you know, sort of black women are the sine qua non of a Democratic Party success, or the black voters are. Two quick comments about that. One, I've been hearing since Jesse Jackson ran in 1984 that the black vote, well, really since 1976, that the black vote is the core vote, right? Without which a Democratic victory is not possible. Well, that's the kind of fun thing you can do with numbers, and you can make any constituency that turns out, or better yet, any statistical category that turns out at disproportionately high numbers for the Democrats or for whatever, you can make the case that that's the key constituency, that's a sine qua non, without which nothing positive or no victory can occur. But and people do it all the time. I mean, when you have a political agenda you're trying to push, that's the kind of a rhetorical argument that you make. We all do it. I'm not saying that it's an immoral thing to do. I'm just saying that it's a way of perceiving what electoral constituencies are like that's connected with some pragmatic agendas, but not necessarily all.
Well, if I'm going to come back to you later about this professional managerial class agenda that you feel, as it were, chasing the black vote weds you to, but I want to get Steve in here, and for people who haven't read it, Steve's last column for The Nation, Democrats Must Change Their Whole Approach Toward White People, is about a white voter problem. But we're putting the shoe on the other foot today, Steve. So where are you in this question?
Well, I think that it's interesting listening about, actually also as an African-American studies major in college, I feel like I'm hearing the professors, I kind of lay out the statistics that Christina was laying out are the statistics that if you look, certainly at the exit polls, African-Americans are the most Democratic voting constituency that there is. And there has been since 76, since we've had, racial exit polls. So that's just kind of what it is. And so then we could talk about what's our analysis of that, or why is that the case, et cetera. But it's clear that that is the most Democratic vote that there is. And it is tied to this, to the piece that I had written, that it's not that black people are necessarily in love with the Democratic Party per se, is that the Republican Party is rooted in and fueled by white nationalism and appeals to white fears and racial resentment. So when you see the one party for white people, black people can look at that and say, well, that we should be going the other direction. So I think as a fundamental matter, it's clear that the black vote is the backbone of the Democratic Party. I think they're also ambivalent, right, in terms of really embracing that agenda. So that's a whole other thing that we can discuss. And fundamentally, it's without a large black turnout is where the real problems are going to happen. There's if the overwhelming majority of those black people who vote are going to vote Democratic. Question is how many are going to vote, and that's I would argue is the current challenge if you look at this current election. But I think where I'm falling is that yes, it's clear and it's logical that Biden would be turning to the black vote because it is in fact the most dependable component of his constituency.
And can I just jump in, Don, just because, in political science, we call it party capture, right? I mean, as Steve laid out, it's like Republicans have chosen to cast their lot with white nationalism. So a lot of black folks are thinking, where do we get to go? But I think also a lot of black voters, it's a general turnout problem. Don't forget, a very robust, successful federal election is when 60% of the voting eligible population bothers to turn out. We know in municipal elections in New York, we can barely crack 25%, which is abysmal and embarrassing and quite dangerous for our, the future of our democracy. But when we think about, you know, Black voters going to the polls, we oftentimes, we don't necessarily vote for our top choice. We have to be strategic. Black voters have to understand white voters. I think this goes to some of Steve's writings. You know, it's like we have to understand the capacity of white people. So oftentimes we don't just always choose our first choice. As Adolf laid out, I do think that some of Bernie Sanders' ideas obviously are much more progressive and would advance, I think, Black people as a group in much more significant and robust ways than some of the standard Democratic rhetoric and policy that we've seen before. But Black people understand white people, and they understand that, you know, Bernie Sanders and his class analysis doesn't fly in the general sense. So I think that's where Biden, as sort of a compromise candidate in the Democratic Party, is much more attractive. I would also argue two things about Bernie Sanders. One, if you're going to vote for the, you know, run on the Democratic Party ticket, be a registered Democrat. That's one. And two, Adolf, I would love to chat with your son, because I think one of the biggest mistakes that Bernie Sanders made during that campaign actually was skipping South Carolina and skipping some events in the South where it appeared that Bernie Sanders didn't care about the Black vote. So Black folks are saying, even if it appears that we're going to vote for Biden, how dare you not even come and ask for our vote? That's an insult to us. So your class analysis, devoid of racial analysis, makes it such that Bernie Sanders ended up where he ended up and Joe Biden ended up as the nominee.
There's nothing that I would find more fun, and I'm sure many nation listeners would agree, than to relitigate 2016 and 2020. But I want to move us to 2024, although I also want to recognize that the analysis you gave is exactly the analysis, which is to say the limitations of white voters and Black voters' strategic sense of that was exactly the analysis that my colleague Elie Mystal put forth in 2020, explaining why he thought Biden was going to be the nominee. But now we're in 2024, and you know, there's this question. We all watched the debate in June on Thursday. We may have various views on that, but I want to start this round with Steve Phillips, because we asked you before the debate whether Biden should drop out, and your answer then was no. Have you had any occasion to reconsider?
No, I have not. And I have an even stronger position that Democrats need to keep moving forward, because it's been all this drama. And so they keep asking the question too incompletely, right? Somebody texted me today, says, where are you at? And should he stay in? Should he drop out? That is not the question. The question is, should he stay in, or should you open the door to all manner of chaos that might end up with J.B. Pritzker, the white billionaire, as the nominee? And so it's not simply a question, and that's the problem with this current discussion, is that everyone, it's, should we have Biden, the known quantity, or should we have the, you know, mythical fantasy candidate in our mind who would be the perfect person? That is not the conversation. And so it will be absolute chaos. And most fundamentally, and this is what I've become even more, I've actually become, because I've had the argue with people about this over these past couple of weeks, more confident about Biden's prospects if I had to think about it more, in that there are more people in this country who vote for the Democrats than vote for the Republicans. Biden won by 7 million votes. 16 million people have turned 18 since 2016. So then you get questions around voter behavior and psychology. So nobody likes Biden. Very few people outside of his family are excited about him. But that's very different. Then how are people going to vote in October and November? So all these polls and all of this energy and all this agita is capturing the dissatisfaction, this kind of inchoate people being in their feelings. But the Democratic constituency is larger, and all of the electoral data bears that out. So that's what we should be focused on.
I feel like if we could bottle what you just said, we could sell cases of it. But this morning, just dropped their big national survey that said for the first time in I don't know how many years, Republican registration leads Democrat. That's purely a party ID question, not a question of Biden versus Trump. And Republicans lead on voters under 30 in party ID. At the same time, the Cook Report, and since this is a horse race broadcast, we can admit to following every twist and turn of every district. The Cook Report switched six states this morning from Trump to Biden. So when you say all the data reflects this agitel, well, as you said before, the data is what the data is, and it doesn't look good for the Democratic ticket.
No, but see, this is where I feel like all these polls are missing things. And so what they are capturing is the dissatisfaction with Biden, the lack of enthusiasm for Biden. That's a very different proposition than how are people going to vote. And if you, and particularly, I'm particularly frustrated and annoyed with the New York Times' polls that have had Black support, I believe in like the 70% or even less realm, where there has never been a Democratic nominee who's gotten less than 83% of the vote. So either something cataclysmic has happened in the past 2 to 3 years, which that should be what people are talking about, or these polls are not actually accurately capturing what the situation is. And so you can, all of these, I don't see the polls as the most relevant data. And the most significant point around this was in November 2023, I'm sorry, that when the New York Times came out with this big ass poll saying that Trump was ahead in 10 different states and people don't like Biden and the Democrats are losing. And then that same week, Democrats almost ran the table in actual elections. They won the Ohio abortion rights measure, took back the Virginia state legislature, did better than they've done in 30, 40 years in the Mississippi gubernatorial election. So actual election results are showing that there are more Democratic voters than Republicans. And so these polls come in, and this Cook thingy, Cook should be challenged to say, and all these people are challenged to say, what is your analysis that when the Democrats had a 7 million vote lead, 16 million people have turned 18, Democrats won 60% of the under 29 vote in 2022 and in 2020. How's that math work? Is there a massive defection going on to Trump? You could argue people might not turn out, and that's the critical piece around what this election is going to be. But I don't put much stock in any of those polls, because I don't think they've been disproven by actual election results, which I would argue is the most important data set to look at.
Can I jump in here too? I mean, Don, I'll defer to you. But I want to say a couple of things. One is I agree with Steve about the polling stuff, right? I mean, for sure. And especially this far out from the actual election. Secondly, I also, and I'll confess, right? I mean, this may mark me as some kind of freak, but I didn't watch the debate, and I haven't watched the replays, and I haven't watched clips from it either. It's probably something Freudian, but instead, of the debate, I watched No Country for Old Men. it wasn't intentional, but it's what popped up. But I got up the next morning and was freaked like everybody else. And I spent the next 3 or 4 days walking around the ramparts trying to talk down friends and comrades and allies who were ready to jump ship. Because the point is, jump ship to what? And I think Steve is absolutely correct. I have since backed away from that position and have landed on what I think is the more pragmatic position, which is, I want the mess to go away. I want the chatter to go away. And whatever way it goes away, I'm going to have to live with, because I can't have any influence on it anyway, right? I'm not one of the very serious people like Paul Krugman, who gets to talk out of his ass about how people got elected. And by the way, speaking of the New York Times is weighing in, probably the most irresponsible thing that I've seen since the debate is the unsigned editorial from the Ed Board that just cavalierly says there are a number of good candidates out there and doesn't mention a name. And we've also, Susan Milligan just has a piece in the New Republic about how problematic trying to replace Biden on the ticket would be at this point, not the least because of the Kamala Harris problem, right? Which people have been trying to pretend out of existence. So that's that. I mean, I just want them somehow to get this done, at least within a couple of days after the Republican convention, because I understand that there's some thinking that the Democrats don't want to do anything definitive until after the GOP meets. What's not going to make what go away? Right. Well, yeah, but like nothing that I say here or in my column or like any place else is going to have any impact on whether it goes away or not. And I think for a lot of us, the key thing is, and this also connects to Steve's point about the actual voting, that the GOTV is the real thing, right? But the get out the vote effort is going to be the real thing. And we're going to have to depend on that for civil rights groups and the labor movement. For 6 weeks after the 2020 election, I answered my phone in Philadelphia by saying, you're welcome from all of us in southeastern Pennsylvania because we put Joe Biden in the White House. And it was because that coalition delivered Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, and Arizona. And that's what we're going to have to depend on again. It really doesn't matter who the candidate is. I mean, I'm absolutely convinced that for the good GOTV efforts, you can nominate a ham sandwich. And as long as the people doing the field work thought that the ham sandwich had a good chance of winning and could sell it and could keep their efforts up, we'd have as good a chance of winning as not. And that's what we have. Now, the one other thing I want to make clear on a slightly different point before I shut up on this round is, you know, there are 42 million black people in the U.S., right? That's more people than there are in Canada, right? And the idea that there's a black agenda that would unite all 42 million of those people or whatever percentage of them are voters is like as silly as saying or as fanciful as saying that there's an agenda that unites all Canadians.
So I think there's a difference between a black vote and a black agenda. So mm-hmm. I think that we can right. have a whole podcast episode about a black agenda, because I do think that that's a lot more complex as a question. But the black vote is big D Democrat. I do think, you know, to put it a little more bluntly than Steve put it, it's like, I play the cards I have, not the cards I want. And I think a lot of this polling is about, you know, what if we had a fantasy, you know, do-over? It's like, we already had a primary. You know, the time to have this conversation about the cards either was in 2020 after the election, you know, right after the election, or 2022, right after the midterm. And we didn't have it as a party. I think, you know, Adolf sort of says, you know, marketing these ideas, you know, Biden and Harris have a lot of wins. I agree fully. The problem is the Democrats don't know how to market ideas or their wins. We saw this with Obama. We see it again with Biden. We see it in local levels. It's like, you all have hits. You all have ways that you have helped millions upon millions of Americans from various racial and ethnic groups, class backgrounds, you name it. And there's like hiding your light under a bushel consistently and letting Republicans set the narrative, letting Republicans set the terms. You're even using Republican talking points. You know, this idea of like pro-life and pro-choice. It's like, that's not even the conversation. The conversation is pro-choice and anti-choice. Like, be the point guard, Democrats, and they don't know how to do that. I think as we move forward, and, you know, we all sort of have talked about Kamala, but it's like, just because there's a fantasy out there, and I agree with you 1,000%, Adolf, the gross irresponsibility of the New York Times editorial board, where it's like, where was this smoke for Donald Trump when he is a convicted felon, 34 right. counts, right? You didn't have a collective, you need to drop out, we can't believe we have a convicted felon on the ballot. So this unsigned op-ed is I think, irresponsible on a whole host of levels, but I've long since stopped looking to the New York Times for responsible coverage on certain things. But here we are. So these are the cards. And it's like, so you're going to leapfrog the black woman who's been next to Joe Biden for 3+ years, who I wrote a piece in the Times actually a few years ago saying it's like her portfolio is a trap. She had everything but Middle East peace and world peace on that portfolio. She had voting rights. She had COVID. She had the border crisis. She had, you know, sort of what's going on in cities with like cops killing people. So it's like, we knew that because she had a portfolio, if she can't solve all the ills of the country that haven't been solved in decades, if it's her time up front, it's like, oh, well, she didn't accomplish anything. And then, you know, you add in racism and sexism and the intersectionality of those two things, and we have a candidate where all of a sudden she's not qualified. You know, you've got people in print saying she's a DEI candidate. And so who's the hope, right? Gavin Newsom, Steve, you know I'm going to pick on you in California, right? Highly problematic on a whole host of levels when we start vetting Gavin Newsom, right? Gretchen Whitmer, solid, but like, you know, her CV can't match Kamala Harris's. Pete Buttigieg, fantastic on Fox News. Don't even get me started. But your Secretary of State, you were in charge of 35 buses in Indiana. You know, South Bend at that, right? So it's like, or Secretary of the Transportation, excuse me, not Secretary of State. So it's like, when we start really looking at these quote unquote ideal candidates that the New York Times mysteriously said, who are they? Because no one has the CV of a Kamala Harris as Vice President of the United States.
Well, let's go there for a bit, because Adolf, you said Democratic Party could nominate a ham sandwich. Well, let's say that there's a ham sandwich named Kamala Harris, and that, because, you know, it's one thing to say you're leapfrogging, all these commentators are leapfrogging over the person who's there and who's next in line, not just by custom, but because she's had the responsibility of knowing that if this, you know, late 70s man stumbled, she was going to have to take the reins. So, you know, there, in other words, do you differentiate between those who say Biden should step aside and open the gates to chaos, as Steve put it so eloquently, or those who say Biden should step aside and let Kamala Harris do the job that she's there to do and not lead the party and its ticket off a cliff, as the polls say that Joe Biden will do if left in place?
Well, see, I'm not sure that Kamala Harris wouldn't lead the party off a cliff either, right? Because she does have those negatives, and no matter how we feel about whether they're justified, right? I mean, they are those negatives. I mean, 2016, right? HRC was a dog of a candidate, and she was a dog of a candidate for a lot of reasons, but among them was sexism, right? But you can't shake some holy water out of the electorate and say you're cured of your sexism. You got to take into account that people are going to vote that way. And I mean, lest we forget, right? And I know, I mean, the Democrats have been doing this every 4 years since at least 1992. That they've been telling us that the candidates aren't offering us much, but the other guys are worse. And if the Republican wins, it'll be the end of civilization as we know it. It's been bullshit up to now, right? But the moral of Aesop's fable is that there eventually was a wolf at the door, and the wolf is at the door now. So, frankly, I think the entire discussion of Biden and all the rest of this, right, has to proceed from the ultimate imperative of defeating Trump and of preempting, right, or preventing like a Republican takeover of all three branches of government and in both houses of Congress. And it seems to me like that's the instrumental thinking that needs to shape this entire discussion, not who deserves what, who's a more attractive candidate, but whatever can be done to stop this juggernaut. Well, I'm sure everybody here is at least taking a look at Project 2025, right? And
The Nation had a cover story on it in July, so I'm sure you've all read that.
Totally.
Yeah, and if I could maybe just jump on that, I want to emphasize this point, which I think gets left out of politics, I don't know, shockingly, whatever, but it is the prevalence and centrality of sexism and misogyny in the electorate, and that we don't grapple, it's like completely skipped over in terms of what happened in 2016 with Hillary, and it's not appreciated in terms of what happened with Stacey Abrams. I mean, what is the primary difference between Raphael Warnock and Stacey Abrams? But it's gender. And so that's a very real problem, challenge, obstacle we have to grapple with. And so, but that's left out of this whole, you know, thing. You know, they're also saying is that this whole thing about this, like, not Biden, there's somebody great out there, but without looking at all of the complexities and all of the challenges and all the difficulties. I mean, I've never seen in politics something as intensely the grass is greener than what we're living through at this moment.
And that's irresponsible. Right. And the danger, especially considering what the real alternatives are. Right. And it seems like not enough people are paying attention to that either.
This is counter to let slide. So I'm sorry, but I was not a political science. I was a philosophy major. And we always believe that it only takes one counterexample. So my counterexample is, unless you believe that sexism in the United States is more deep, pervasive, and tenacious than racism, Why was Barack Obama possible and Kamala Harris impossible?
I actually believe it is deeper. Go ahead, Christine. But that's what struck me when Hillary ran, is you can't say something right. You can't get caught on tape saying something racist. That will destroy you. But Donald Trump has proven that being caught on tape saying misogynist stuff will not destroy you.
he's also now proven that you can say highly racist stuff, and it's great. But so here's the thing. One, I need to remind, you know, your listeners know this because it's The Nation, but just in case we've got newcomers, you know, there's only been two black female senators, U.S. senators in the history of the United States, Carol Mosley Braun from Illinois in 92, Year of the Woman, and then Kamala Harris in 2016, state of California, right? There have been zero black female governors. Stacey Abrams came the closest, but we still have never had a black female governor in the history of the United States. So like that, zoom out and really sit with that on all the different races and offices that we've had. So this country's also not accustomed to black executive leadership, right? We've had black mayors, black female mayors, but not governors. And, you know, the Senate numbers are quite small. I think 2008 with Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton, a few things. One, fortune favors the bold. I think the Clintons underestimated how many people disliked the Clintons. And so Hillary Clinton got swept up a lot in her husband's nonsense. She ran a bad campaign in 2008. Right. She didn't think this 44-year-old man whose middle name was Hussein was going to do anything. Barack Obama is a once-in-a-lifetime type orator. Right. And so he connected with people. And there were a lot of people who were just tired of the Clinton nonsense. Every week there was some nonsense out of that White House. I think a lot of people, you know, gender wise, the sexism is real, as Steve laid out. So they didn't want to vote for this woman. And don't forget, Oprah, that was when Oprah's peak Oprah, she decided that she was going to make a president. So she was able to move white women to Barack Obama. Don't forget, black women were the holdouts for a long time. They were with Hillary Clinton. Many black women of a certain age voted for Hillary Clinton over Barack Obama in the primary. And slowly but surely, he proved to black women that he could be the president and should be the nominee. And they came around slowly but surely. So that was a really competitive primary, if we remember. It went toe-to-toe, right? Barack Obama won Iowa, and it wasn't because Hillary Clinton gave some fake crocodile tears in New Hampshire that she barely won New Hampshire, because if not, she would have been out for the count from the beginning. So I think as we can have a postmortem 2008, but it's a fascinating racial and gender dynamic because Barack Obama was the cool black friend and Hillary Clinton was the nagging older white woman that a lot of people did not want to vote for. And don't forget, in that campaign, they kept Michelle Obama in the closet until she had a total redo and then came out as like the new cool black best friend. But don't forget, she was too bold, too smart, too aggressive, too mean, too angry, too militant, all those things. And no one, she was relegated to HBCUs and black churches only until she had a total makeover.
One of the things that struck me in your account of 2008, you know, was that there was time. There was time for Obama to prove to black women that their assessment of the white electorate was unduly pessimistic. There was time for Michelle Obama to be repackaged. You know, we've got less than a month before the Democrats nominate their presidential candidate. We've got, you know, not that long, 3 months till the election. Is there time for anything? And if there isn't time for anything, is it just close your eyes, put your hands over your ears, and just hope that Joe Biden doesn't lead us off a cliff?
There's not time, first of all. And then as Christina was saying, we had time. We had a primary election. And people did not step forward and say that we should have any of these other people, Richard Whitmer or Gavin Newsom or anybody. We had a primary and Biden won the primary. So let's be clear upon that. Now, we can't have this one bad debate and then every celebrity and rich person is going to invoke their extensive electoral experience to handpick the nominee. It's nonsense. But most fundamentally, in that this is what I've been trying to lift up out there. And actually, Ron Brownstein, the writer and journalist, lifted this up in 2012, where he talks about the coalition of restoration and the coalition of transformation. This country is fundamentally divided now. And so it's really always been divided, but it's incredibly sharp right now. And so, and what we're missing is that we're just skipping over how the Republicans are not losing any support. So you would not come up with a candidate who'd been an insurrectionist and who's twice impeached and 34 felony counts and caught on tape talking about grabbing women and say, this is our nominee. This is not going to be a viable person, but he's lost zero support. And so that is reflective of the fundamental rigid divide within the country. It's that person with his coalition, and then it's our nominee, whoever that is, with our coalition. And the Democratic coalition is larger And the reason we know this is by how obsessed that the Republicans are with stopping people from voting. And so so there's not time, and then it's not necessary. It's not like someone's going to lead us off the cliff. That is not how elections play themselves out anymore. There's not some huge number of voters who are just looking to see who does the best in a debate, and then they're all going to swing and follow that person. There's their coalition and then there's our coalition. Ours is bigger. If we stay focused, if we inspire it, if we organize it, if we turn it out, we will win. And then we can have all these debates for the next 4 years.
With all due respect, there are two things that I know I was going to shut up, but I've got to come back on two things. One is the notion that the primaries that happened in 2024 were any kind of a Democratic mandate for anybody. I mean, we could relitigate whether 2020 was really a Democratic mandate or whether it was not the Democratic Party machine, which has been hollowed out successively since the Clintons ran it, putting its finger on the scales to keep Bernie Sanders from being the nominee. But let's leave out 2020 and talk about 2024. Was that really a democratic process? Is that like, I mean, I think North Korea has elections that are more democratic than the democratic primary in 2020.
It was more democratic than some democratic donors and celebrities saying after a debate, let's knock him out. I can tell you that much. Everyone had the chance to step forward and put their name on and run, but they did not.
Right. I mean, this is like the only reason why Barack Obama was successful, and I tell my students this all the time, just as I want them to think about running for office at some point in time. It's like fortune favors the bold. Sometimes you have to go after an incumbent or a perceived incumbent, you know, and a lot of times it doesn't work. But we see when it does work, it's a real hit, right? I mean, my state senator took out a very established incumbent in Brooklyn. No one thought he could do it. He was some young 30-something-year-old who, you know, had gone to Fordham and then Cornell. It happens, and it can happen, but I think a lot of people just say, like, oh, well, I'll just wait until 2028, and then I'll run with everyone else. And it's like, well, you know what? You missed your window. And so here we are. This is how we get a debate stage of 24 people who all feel like they missed their window at some point in time. It's like, if you really wanted it and you thought that you were the best person, you should have put your case forward and you should have convinced people the same way Barack Obama convinced people that this 44-year-old who'd been in the Senate for 20 minutes was ready to take on the presidency and take out the most powerful Democratic family in modern history. So he did it. If people were really that itching after 2022, they should have done it, and they didn't. So here are the cards. We've got an octogenarian being supported by the CBC, octogenarian James Clyburn, octogenarian Maxine Waters, octogenarian Nancy Pelosi. They're all supporting their octogenarian, right? You've got a black woman who's the child of two immigrants waiting in the wings. Now all of a sudden everybody's apoplectic. These were the cards, y'all. These have always been the cards. So I don't understand, you know, after we saw Joe Biden's long in the tooth at the debate, we've known that. The thing is, the administration has been doing things to help the country. So we're voting for an administration. We're voting for an agenda. We're voting for a party. We're not just voting for Joe Biden. And I think, to Steve's point, you know,
aren't we also voting to keep out Donald Trump? I mean, I suppose this was the point I was trying to sharpen sufficiently to put to you, Steve, but I'd be very happy to hear any of you on it, which is, it seems to me that the discontent, and it's not just from celebrities and it's not just from rich people. And I think that the Biden camp is trying to spin it that way, but I think there, you know, plenty of ordinary people I speak to are desperate for something to.
Well, they're scared.
People don't understand how elections work anymore. And that's what I've been trying to get people to understand. We look at it like the Super Bowl, where you've got these two teams on the field, and if our team doesn't score more points in the debate, then we're going to lose and we need to get a better competitor. What elections are now is which team brings more fans to the game. And it almost doesn't even matter about the players. If we get our people out, then we are going to win the election. The mental model and the framework people have is inappropriate and incorrect for this political moment that we're in. And we're seeing it with the Republican side. And we should recognize that the immutability of the Republican vote, of the man who had, there is nobody who would have said that this is the model of a candidate that you want to put forward for the presidency, and yet he's not losing any support, should show us that voters are voting based upon what's really, which side are you on and what's your vision of the country?
Steve, quarterbacks hated by a lot of their fans.
Yeah, but so what? So what? As long as you win and keep the other guys out. So, yes, let me just say one last thing real quick, just to maybe distill it. So my niece, who was a college student, she distilled this sort of Zoom family Zoom call 2 years ago. She said, none of my friends want Biden to run again. And none of my friends could agree on who should. That is the exact situation that we are in. And so all of the polls, all of this stuff shows this fundamental dissatisfaction, which is widespread and deep. But that's very different than these people are not going to vote when it comes down to Biden versus Trump.
Yeah. So yeah. All right. So I want to say that. Yeah. I want to unite with Steve around that last point in particular. But I also want to stress something else that I've said for a long time that we put way too much stock in elections, and it makes sense that we would do it now, certainly. But I've always said that elections that the electoral realm is the realm for consolidating and institutionalizing victories that have been won on the plane of social movement organizing, right? The right wing has been out organizing our side on the ground, at least since Goldwater's defeat. And there are multiple reasons for that, but you know, not the least of them is like 30 plus years of bipartisan commitment to a neoliberal program of a regressive transfer. Right, that leaves more and more ordinary people, as you put it, of whatever colors and genders, feeling insecure about their lives. Right, healthcare, housing, jobs, job security, quality of education for their kids, and that's where a lot of the disaffection comes from. Right, and the skepticism comes from. I mean, we're doing trainings with union workers that we do. Like, well, one of the things we've been startled by is how successful the right has been in demonizing government. And the Democrats have colluded with them since Clinton, right, to demonize government, right? To sell the assumption that private is better. The Obama administration's approach to education was constantly pissing on public education, right? So if you demonize the public institutions, people don't have anything else. They don't know where to turn. But my good friend Anthony Mazzocchi always said that democratic neoliberalism isn't going to be able to deliver the goods. It's not going to be able to deliver enough to make most people feel, or to make enough people feel secure about their lives. And if we, as progressives or whatever we are, can't find credible explanations to offer people and credible strategies for addressing the problems that they're really concerned with, then these much more dangerous forces out there are going to make use of scapegoating and demonizing people. And that's what we've been watching happen for more than a decade now, and certainly since the rise of Trump. And that's the fault line where we are. That's a crevice that we've approached in this society now. They don't need to tell the truth. That they don't need to be honest. All they need to do is win one election, or make it look like they won one election, and that could very well be the end of even the formalist democracy as we understand it. In the U.S., it's certainly what I'm likely to be the end of all the protections that we've won for working people again of all genders and races, right, over the last century. And that's all about to go. And I think that our side doesn't pay enough attention to the actual dangers that we're facing. And I think one reason that it doesn't, and this goes back to a point that you made, Christine, a few minutes ago. One of the reasons that the Democrats seem to be hiding their light under a bushel is that when they have boasted about doing things for working people, Wall Street and the donor class have rebelled against it. So they want to keep it muted. Right? Like the way they've treated the labor movement for the last 20 years. Like, we had 3 a.m. recall. They want to do stuff for us. Stand on it.
Here's the piece. You know, Adolf just mentioned the word scapegoat, and my ears perked up because this is the whole hand-wringing about Black men possibly leaving the Democratic Party. That's the setup already. So that if Democrats don't win, it's like, well, we could have won, but, you know, the Black men, they're the ones who did it. It's like, you know who the problem is? It's white people voting against their own interests. It's, you know, people of color, not Black people, but but people of color across these 50 states voting against their own interests. And I've said it before, and I'm sure some listeners are going to clutch their pearls, but I'm going to say it again. White people do not understand the capacity of white people. Black people do. And when we say that this particular election and the rollbacks that could happen, that will happen in widespread ways that will affect a lot of people, and not just people of color, and not just immigrants, and not just poor people. They will affect everyday white folks, middle-class ones at that, possibly upper-middle-class white people. White people don't understand that because oftentimes they haven't been on the side of the cruelty of white politicians. Black voters have been on that side of cruelty. They know what it looks like. They've seen it. They've heard the stories. They've lived in the places where it's already happened. So until I think white Democrats can get their minds together around the real, true existential threat that exists, and also independents. White Republicans, they've drank the Kool-Aid and they're not coming back. But until people can really see that, we're going to keep having these circular discussions as to like, well, I don't know. You know, lots of people are like, well, I'm not going to vote, or I'm so disappointed in Democrats. I'm going to sit this one out. Or maybe I'm looking at the Republican Party. How are you so disappointed in the age of Joe Biden that you're now thinking about voting for Donald Trump? Make that make sense. It doesn't make sense. So that means you secretly wanted to vote for Donald Trump and his antics anyway. And so I think that we're having several conversations, but the real conversation is the history of race and racism in this country, and how every single policy can be led back to racism in this country. And there are far too many voters who do not take seriously the real threat that Donald Trump and his entire administration poses.
No, yeah, I can't go there. No, but I'll leave it alone for now. That's another discussion.
Okay. Your predictions for the election by percentage nationally.
No, I never make predictions. As a political scientist, I don't make percentage predictions. Like, I mean, listen, Democrats have won every single race since 2000, with the exception of 2004.
And I'll say this too, like we can't lose. It's just that simple, right? I mean, a phrase that's been going through my head since the debate and from talking to friends from the Battle of Stalingrad is, there's no land beyond the Volga, right? Not one step back. We just can't afford to lose this. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah. And I actually think that this whole nonsense has forced me to like sharpen my analysis, look back at different pieces, et cetera. I'm actually more confident today than even before the debate that the Democrats are going to win. The numbers show it. And all of this drama does not understand really human behavior, in that there will have to be on the order of 10 million people to switch from supporting the Democrats. And so this has not played itself out. People are completely misinterpreting the dissatisfaction and then extrapolating that to predict voter behavior. And I'm actually fairly confident that Biden and the Democrats are going to win re-election.
And we're nowhere near November. I mean, we don't have time and we do have time at the same time, right? I mean, we still have several months for a lot of different things to play out. We've had a week and a half of Trump being somewhat disciplined and somewhat quiet. We know that that won't last very long.
Okay, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you all. We should definitely do this again before the election. If not on this topic, then on another one. This was just terrific conversation.
In the new book, The Wannabe Fascists, Federico Finkelstein offers a precise explanation of why Trumpism and similar movements across the world belong to a new political breed, the wannabe fascists. Drawing on almost three decades of research on the histories of fascism and populism around the world, Finkelstein lays out in clear language what the author calls the four pillars of fascism: xenophobia, propaganda, political violence, and ultimately, dictatorship. Learn more about The Wannabe Fascists by Federico Finkelstein at ucpress.edu.